Welcome everyone to episode number 102 of Underserved. Joining me today is Jim Scholhammer, CEO at Ultra Clean Technology. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Jim, thank you so much for joining us today on Underserved.
Thanks for having me, Andrew. Good to be here.
So way back when, you're a kid collecting rocks. How does that kind of change your elementary school experience?
Yeah, I grew up in Northern Illinois. There wasn't a lot to do, basically surrounded by cornfields. So I used to go out under the ocean at one time. So I'd go collect fossils and rocks. Had quite a collection by the time I reached, you know, fourth or fifth grade.
And you were in Catholic school. How did that change your curriculum there?
Yeah, it was rather funny because I went at the age where the nuns still wore their habits and it was all nuns teaching. And when it came to teaching the science and the geology courses, they didn't have that discipline. So they asked me to teach, you know, the units, especially the geology units. And so for a few weeks, I got to be the teacher in fifth grade, which paid off nicely. I got a good grade in that class.
You better if you're teaching it. So you kind of knew in the back of your head, I got to go to college. How does that decision tree work?
It was not so much the back of my head, but in my face. You know, my parents from an early age, it was, you know, when you're counting how many years of school you had left, they always added the four. It was always a given that all that my two sisters, my brother and I were going to college. There was no negotiating that. But I didn't know much about it. You know, there wasn't much in the way of counselors back then or special advisors that people now hire. I said, well, you know, Dad, I don't know what I want to do. You know, I love history and, you know, archaeology and things like that, and kind of raised one eyebrow. And without really saying it, I could tell my tuition wasn't going to get covered if I chose what he considered a fluffy career. He was a mechanical engineer at GE for 35 years and his father for 35 years at GE. So he kind of convinced me to go into engineering, went to University of Michigan into the engineering school.
And what discipline of engineering do you choose?
It's funny because most of the people I knew, they had knew right away what they were going to do and what engineer they wanted to be. And I wasn't even sure I wanted to be an engineer, let alone what type of engineer. And so I remember you had to declare the major. So there was a session where they had the different, you know, electrical engineering, mechanical engineering, all the typical tables set up to try to recruit you to come to their program before declaration. And there was a small group of people at the material science and engineering table, and they were really friendly. And there was like a family kind of feeling to it. You know, the EE and the ME was, you know, looked like a kind of a mill. You know, there were so many people over there. I go, well, it's similar to geology and, you know, it looks like a nice place to be, and did put a lot of thought into it, but it was the closest thing to something I did kind of like. So I went into material science, materials and metallurgical engineering at the time it was called.
Now, are you like a voracious student or are you kind of like,
Well, as you could tell, I didn't have passion at the time. I sat in the back and did a lot of crossword puzzles and things like that. I had the ability to kind of hear what was going on and do crossword puzzles and also kind of soak it in. But there was one professor, his name was Van Vlack, and he was kind of the pioneer of material science. All the basic material science and metallurgical textbooks, you know, he's the godfather of all of that. People are still using his books today. He would come in and do a lecture every now and then, and he would get so passionate, you know, his shirt would come untucked. By the end, he had chalk all over his body, waving his arms around crystal structures and things like that. You couldn't help but kind of, you know, pick up his passion for it. So things got a little bit more interesting for me, but it was never really my true passion at the time, but it worked out pretty well.
So you're getting towards the end of college, time to start figuring out a career. What are most of your contemporaries doing?
So in Michigan, as you could imagine, most of them were going into the auto industry. And I had a few interviews with a company in Elkhart, Indiana that did automotive parts and in Peoria for Caterpillar. And, you know, several of them were like, oh, I'm going to go work on bumpers, you know, new plastics for bumpers. And to me, although I appreciate bumpers, and I've used them more than once. It didn't sound very interesting to me. And I went to this small company in Troy, Michigan called Energy Conversion Devices. They sold research and IP, and they were working on everything that was a long shot, like superconductors, super magnets, anything with the word super in it. They were kind of doing R&D in it. I was taking the tour, and I looked in the quartz window of one of the machines where they were doing certain optics. And I saw this plasma, and it was a PVD, a sputtering machine, describing how these ions are knocking out the atoms off of this material one at a time and laying down atom by atom. And I thought, wow, this is really cool. And it was definitely the lowest paying offer I had. And it wasn't a great time to come out in 88, 89. It was a recession. And I wasn't a great student, so I didn't have a lot of options, but I just followed what was interesting, and I went there. I think my starting salary was $28,000 a year in 1989. Gives you an indication of inflation since then.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds more interesting than plastic bumpers. Right? So you're getting started in the optical field. Like, what are some of the things that they're building then?
Yeah, that was the real interesting part. I was working with all these incredible PhDs from Lawrence Livermore and Los Alamos and Argonne National Lab, making on these short-field quartz optics, doing ultraviolet coatings and X-ray coatings. So these were special optics that went up on telescopes onto satellites. And there's a kind of special technique that was developed to look at the radiation coming off of stars. Now, that's a difficult thing to do because hydrogen and helium swamps all the detectors because that's the majority of the radiation. But together with this incredibly bright professor at Los Alamos, she designed this special coating. These are atomic layers. I mean, three atoms deep and then two atoms of something else, you know, high Z and low Z materials that would throw the hydrogen and helium radiation away from the detector and so that they could look at some of the heavier elements coming out of stars. So I learned a lot. I put my thumbprint on the back of the optic before we'd ship it because I wanted a piece of me to be in outer space. So I'm sure it evaporated within minutes of being out there, but it was pretty fun. Also worked on tribological coatings, which are dry lubricants on bearings for Lockheed. And these were for the laser guns for the Star Wars program under Reagan, SDI. So these were oil and grease doesn't work in outer space for the same reason my fingerprint still isn't there. So I did these special coatings on the balls of the ball bearing as well as the inner and outer races for the Star Wars program. And dozens of little projects and programs like that, they were just presented with a challenge to do something nobody's done, you know, coated dry coating on bearing balls and things like that. So I had to do a lot of hardware and process modifications. It was really fascinating work to do, to be involved with.
Sounds like you're running at a hard pace for short money for quite a while, though. What's that like?
Oh, yeah. I was a VIP member of Super 8 because I remember there was one time we were doing these large gimbal bearings for the defense program and the deposition times, the run times were, you know, 6-7 hours. And once you tune the coating in, you just wanted to run the actual product through in different batches. And so a technician and I would get a couple rooms at the Super 8 across the street and you'd get up every 4 to 5 hours to remove the bearings from the chamber and then clean the new ones and put them in. And so it'd be like around the clock, you know, whenever the machine was finally tuned in and ready, you had to strike. But like I said, it didn't feel like work. It was kind of fun. Yeah. At one point, the technician and I, we had found a bunch of old hardware in a closet. So around this place, because it was an R&D center, there was all this just equipment laying around from past projects. So we just said, hey, wouldn't it be fun to put together a whole deposition machine just from the scrap parts we found? So we built a machine from scratch from different parts we found to do different PVD coatings and vacuums. So it was that kind of place. It's like if you wanted to try something or do something, there was plenty of opportunity. But you're right, it was long hours and low pay. But, you know, I was young and I could do it.
So eventually that's got to wear and someone's got to recruit you away. What happens?
It was fun, but the company had been what it was forever. Unfortunately, it's now out of business because they got into the whole solar frenzy. They'd been doing solar for 30 years. They started doing solar cells in the lab right next to me there. They were doing the solar cells that would go up on satellites, you know, special ones that were specially coated. So they got into kind of commercial production of flexible solar for rooftops and overbuilt and got caught up in the whole solar sweep. Unfortunately, put the company out of business. But long before that. That was long after I left. I just realized I learned a lot. I kind of learned, you know, how does a vacuum work? How do pumps work? Valves, you know, deposition, PVD, CVD deposition. How does it all work? If I want to do something with a career, I'm going to have to switch into an industry that actually makes product. So that's what I did. That was a 91. Now, that was pre-Google and pre any ability to do easy research. So I looked, living in Michigan at the time, and I looked on the map and said, oh, Minnesota's not that much farther north. It must be similar weather, but couldn't have been more wrong. But I got recruited to go to a company in Minnesota called Apogee, and it had a division called Virotech Thin Films. And we're doing optical coatings for CRTs, laser scanners, fax machines, you know, really high-level anti-reflection coatings and enhanced mirrors in a machine that had been originally designed to do disk drives, but didn't work. And so it was retrofitted to make these optical coatings. And it was completely the wrong machine to be doing what we were trying to do. And talk about a startup-like situation. I started out as a process engineer and then became the engineering manager. And then we kept going through operations executives quickly. And so after a period of frustration, I told the GM, you know, give me the head of ops job too. So when I get the machine ready to go, there's actually people to run it, load it. I want to give me the whole thing. And so that's what I did, but with the wrong equipment and process with a CPK far below one. I grounded out over 6 years, and it was a 24/7 operation. I lived in St. Paul, and this was an hour south in Faribault, Minnesota. And I would work 12, 14, 16 hour days. I'd get home at 2 a.m. after getting the system up and running correctly and put my head on the pillow, and at 3 or 4, they call and say, we lost control, and I'd have to drive back down again. So it was like a startup without any of the financial benefits of a startup. But we were a team, and we were all into it, and we actually drove our competitor out of that field and became like one of the big products we made was the glare filter. I don't know if you remember on the CRT, you'd hang a glare filter over it. So we became like the large market share for making those glare filters. So I'd like to say I predicted the demise of CRTs and the rise of flat panels, and that was, you know, why I moved out of there. But in reality, it was I had just survived my 6th winter in St. Paul, and I went out onto my hammock to read a book, a history book, of course, and I got attacked by mosquitoes, which Minnesotans call the state bird. And I got so frustrated, I threw my book down and went in and called a headhunter. And that's when I ended up at Applied Films in Colorado, which people think of as also a harsh winter, but it's actually much more moderate than a lot of people realize.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Maris Consulting Group, embracing the power of people in technology. For more information, visit mariscg.com. That's MARISCG.com.
Colorado's beautiful, too. I hope you got to enjoy some of the scenery there, not just 16-hour days.
No, that was a more rational work schedule. Applied Films was doing specialty coatings and also building the equipment for flat panel displays for both LCDs and plasma TVs. I was right there in Longmont, Boulder area, and I remember seeing the mountains just come out of the plains, just boom, like a wall with white tops. And I said to myself, every day when I drive into work, I'm going to, you know, drink this in. And I have an office window that looked right out over the range in the mountains. I found myself a few years in going days or weeks without ever even glancing at the mountains. So it's like, I guess it's a human tendency. You take it for granted, but it was definitely a beautiful spot.
How is that company kind of progressing? I think there was some M&A that started to change the trajectory.
Yeah, for years it started as a startup with a couple founders and doing these coatings for LCD. And then in the late 90s, when the tech stocks, you know, really took off, the new CEO came in and he took advantage of it. And he went in the back room and printed up a bunch of shares. So did a lot of secondaries. And so we were a pretty hot stock. And so we raised a lot of money and then actually bought a company in Germany called Leibold Large Area Coatings. It was a company that was about 150 years old, you know, the kind of German company where you go in and the Geschäftsführer, the leader, has his great-grandfather picture on the wall, grandfather's father, and then they all look identical. It's 150-year-old. It was about 10 times the size of our company. And they were doing a lot of the same things that we were doing in Colorado, which I was running. And so the German company had far more momentum in the market than we had, and a lot bigger. So my job was to shut it down. So I was, you know, shutting down both the coding and the equipment part of the business, which I was then running. My boss, the CEO, said, you know, would you like to go run the Germany thing? And I didn't speak German despite my last name. And I went, oh, my wife will never go for this. But, you know, I went home and said, hey, you know, we could go be an expat in Germany for a couple of years. And she said, sure, which surprised me quite a bit. So I had three kids at the time. They were very young, 6, 4, and 2. And so we picked up and moved to Germany. And I was the American, the Geschäftsführer is what it's called, the business leader, the GM. I was the leader of, so it was me and 500 Germans. So it was pretty challenging, but it was an incredible experience.
I hope you got to enjoy some of the beautiful scenery over there too.
Oh yeah. You know, as I said, I was a history buff. I got extended a couple of times. So I actually spent 4 years over there, but every week I didn't know how long we'd be there. So every weekend I just get the map and find a town somewhere in Europe, usually within an hour or two. And you look for like the sign that there was a castle there and a cathedral, and every town had one. So in Altstadt, an old town. And so just pile the kids in the Volkswagen Chiron minivan and just drive to a different city. We were 4 hours from Prague, from Munich, from Berlin, from Paris, from Amsterdam. So every weekend, in fact, a lot of the Germans that I worked with said that I'd seen more of Europe than they had. So I took full advantage of it. The kids were definitely, I remember my youngest daughter, and I tease her about this today. She said, do we have to go to Paris again? And so now she's like, I don't even remember. That's not fair. So, like I said, it was a wonderful experience. About halfway in, you know, I took a few German lessons here or there, but German is not an easy language to pick up. But one day I was at an all-hands meeting and somebody asked a question, of course, in German. And for some reason, it just clicked. You know how languages just click and you could suddenly think in the other language? And I gave a response back in German, like a 10-minute long response back in German to the guy. I'd never spoken German during the all-hands meetings before. It was always interpreted. There was this shocked kind of silence after I was done. And I can imagine everyone trying to think what they had said in front of me over the last few years that I might have. And then they broke out into applause because they appreciated the, I'm sure the German was pretty awful, but they appreciated, you know, the attempt. And they were as surprised as I was when I finally broke into their language.
So what happens at the end of your tour of duty over in Europe?
So I actually decided to come back. You know, my wife missed her family. And right around the time we were going to come back, Applied Materials came by, and Applied Films had a really strong position in display equipment, especially the PVD side, the physical vapor deposition side. Some people call it sputtering. And also solar technology was pretty far advanced in Germany. And so we had a lot of products in the thin film and crystalline solar space too on the equipment side. And at the time Applied, well, they still have the display division. Applied was really strong in the CVD part of the processes, but not the PVD. And same with thin film solar. They're making a big push into solar at the time. Very good CVD technology, but didn't have the PVD side of solar, which Applied Films had. So it was really a perfect fit. And so did the due diligence. It was obviously held to be top secret. You know, we told all the people in Germany, it was just a SOX audit. That's why we're getting all these papers together, but it was due diligence. And I remember giving tours at night to the Applied people. And anyhow, the deal went through. And when I came back to look for a house before the deal went through, you know, they brought me into a room and said, okay, you know, we just want to ask you a few questions. And little did I know, it was like, it was an 8-hour day where each group would come through for an hour and say, okay, this is engineering. Okay, this is operations. This is R&D. This is IT. This is, you know, legal. And every hour, 10 people would march out and 10 people would come in. So it turned into this due diligence session where I was the only one from the applied film side. But because I was COO and CTO, which was a small company, weird combination, you know, normally you don't find that, I would be the one sitting there answering all the questions. So after each people leave, like, okay, who's here from the applied film side? It's like, still me. And so they said, okay, we, you know, this guy knows what he's doing. And I only had a bachelor's in engineering, and everyone at Applied has a PhD from Stanford or MIT or Berkeley. So they're like, well, you know technology, but, you know, we really need ops, operational people, which, you know, I kind of accidentally fallen into ops operations, you know, several times throughout my career. And so I went on and they offered me a position as the head of operations for the display and thin film solar section of Applied. And so that's what I took.
So you become part of Applied Materials. How does the market treat you when you arrive?
It was pretty hot. It was busy as well. And that was the adjustment to, you know, as a Midwestern person to Silicon Valley. I mean, obviously the pace, more direct, I would say, on expectations and less Midwest nice and more of a pressure cooker, right? That was an interesting adjustment for me. Most of the management at Applied Films, you know, left pretty quickly because, like I said, it was pretty fast-paced. But we were doing really well. I built a factory in Taiwan, and so that got us a lot of advantages in the display areas. Started that at Applied Films and expanded it under Applied Materials. And then after 3 years, the GM of the display division. So Applied had division of a semiconductor service and then solar and other, you know, LED and kind of other like mishmash of things and then display. And so there were four divisions. And so when the GM left, he said, hey, Jim, you think of Jim as an ops guy, but he actually was a GM and has some technology background too. So I made the unusual jump of going from the head of ops to the GM of the display division. People that didn't know me, they're like, why is an ops guy running this division? But I wasn't really a true ops guy. So that's where I went from 2008 to 2011. I ran the display division of Applied, and it grew pretty dramatically as flat panels took off.
What happens when the recession hits?
Yeah, that was rough. You know, I mentioned we built a factory in Taiwan, but we actually had built a pretty heavily outsourced operational network. And a lot of that was there when I got there. And then I expanded on it. And display tools are basically large semiconductor tools on steroids. They're a lot of the same architecture, just a lot bigger to make a TV instead of a wafer. So they're kind of modular. I think of it as like Lego with six major pieces, you know, the factory interface module, the vacuum transfer module, the process modules, and so on. And so we had suppliers that would make each module, and then they would either come together and get consolidated in Singapore, or they'd come together in the parking lot of Samsung or LG or wherever. We called it merge and transit. So it was heavily outsourced. So our revenue went from, you know, $250 million a quarter down to $87 million, like overnight. But because we had such a variable cost model, you know, where you just stop cutting POs, you don't have a lot of fixed costs. So we actually broke even, dropping from $250 million in revenue to, it was 87 or 97. It was sub 100 million in a very short period of time. We actually broke even. So we were held up as like, why can't you guys over here do the same thing as display? But it was intentional, but it was also, you know, a little bit lucky as well.
I'd rather be lucky than good.
If you're lucky and good, that's the key.
Hey, sport. How was school today?
It was okay, Dad. How was work?
Ugh. Actually, I had a rough day. Leading an engineering team is hard. I mean, I have to ship new software, meet deadlines, and tackle new projects while keeping my team focused on the day-to-day. It's hard to keep up.
Jeepers, Dad. Why don't you call Maris? They're the staffing firm with the best technical resources around. They helped Billy's dad. He used to be stressed out like you. He was missing deadlines, his team was overworked, and a bunch of folks left the company because it was too stressful. But then he called Maris. And they put resources to work right away. He hit all his deadlines and freed up his team to do other work. His boss was so happy that Billy's dad got some extra time off.
Time off? Wow. What did he do with that?
He spent it with Billy. Aww.
That's a swell idea, son. I'll call Maris today. Now, you go wash up for supper.
So So when things start to recover again, they ask you to run the 200 millimeter equipment group. What is, for folks that don't know the semiconductor industry, what does it 200 millimeter mean in this context?
As you know, to follow Moore's law, there are two things that main drivers that were happening. One is obviously shrinking the dimensions of the circuitry on the wafer. But in parallel, what was happening is the size of the wafer being coated that, you know, the chips get cut out of the silicon wafer. And that was through the early 2000s. In the early 2000s, then the industry made its last jump in wafer size to a 300 millimeter diameter wafer. So there was still a lot of 200 millimeter equipment being used, especially when the chip sizes are small, like MEMS and you know, analog chips and power devices and things that didn't require huge volumes of chips. So 200 millimeter market, even though the industry had switched to 300 millimeter wafers, there was still a very strong demand, especially from the automotive companies like ST, Infineon, and Bosch, as well as a lot of the companies in Taiwan and China making kind of lower end chips or specialty chips. The group had gotten themselves a little bit in over their head because they kind of immediately went to an outsourcing model of the whole tool. That didn't go well, as well as the demand went through the roof and couldn't keep up. And so had really gotten financially was starting to actually impact Applied. So I was asked by the CEO to go over there and fix it. I didn't know anything about semiconductor at the time. It's funny, people look at me as a semiconductor person now, but I'm actually was, you know, most of the people in semi have been in there for 30 years, and I was new into that space. And so, you know, we brought the operations back in-house because they were kind of onesie-twosies. It was high mix, low volume, and so it wasn't really conducive to outsourcing. So we brought it back in-house and developed some R&D. It was really difficult because a lot of Applied ex-service people who knew how to retrofit or refit a tool had set up these little, I call them garage shops. You know, they would buy a used tool. You know, when companies like Intel and others went to 300, they just took all their 200 millimeter tools and put them in inventory and sold them off into the market as used tools. And so a lot of these competitors were small job shops, and they'd sell them at a low price, sell them for $1.2 million and make a couple hundred thousand and do four of those a year. And because they were a company of one or two people, they were happy. And so they really kind of killed the pricing in that space too. So it was pretty tough competition going against, you know, used tools that were very efficiently refurbed for new uses in the automotive space. So kind of had to like find a way around that. And one of the ways that we did that was these tools, because they were developed in the 80s and 90s, the technology on them was still pretty old. So they actually used a floppy disk and a Motorola 86 series chip and a light pen for the controls, and you know, no power, no emergency power source, and so on. So like the users of the tools, they'd have to go on eBay to find floppies and to get a replacement chips, you know, Motorola chips, and then every night they have to go around with a floppy for 12 hours to back up the tools. And so we developed a controller using, you know, the Pentium 5 chip, using a touch screen, using USB memory and a UPS. We kind of upgraded the 200 millimeter offering so we could compete on more than just price. We didn't realize at the time when we did this, we thought, you know, we were kind of selling these features that were more convenience, but the old controllers were so slow that, you know, to tell it to close a valve or turn on a power supply, the delay would be so long that when we put the new controller in, the tool output went up 10%. And because the controller was so slow and things weren't happening exactly when they thought they were, valves were open when they shouldn't be, the yields went up 10%. So that was an unexpected positive result. In addition, there was another kind of lucky factor here, going back to the lucky and good, as the used tools started to get, you know, depleted. There started to be less and less of them. As a result of that, we took back almost the full market share of that market. And so went from 200 million to 500 million. And now I think they're closer to $1 billion in that tool set. So that was an interesting challenge. And like I said, a little bit of smarts and a little bit of luck, you know, we were able to do some great things.
Now, you had an interesting quote on the pre-call that Applied Materials was like Harvard. It gives you a network of everyone and everything. How does that kind of help you in the next step?
Yeah, I'm kind of the poster child of not planning my career. and it just, you know, I've learned a lot about, if I were to plan a career, you know, what are the important impacts, but mostly things just happened to me. At Applied, I didn't, you know, I wasn't trying to make a network, but because I was running one of the four divisions, I'd be up on stage presenting every, you know, quarter or two to the rest of the company, the rest of the VPs. So I was pretty well known. And so after I left Applied and went to UCT, all these people come out of the woodwork. Hey, Jim, I just started up this company. Can you make this for us? And you know, it's, as I walk around, I run into all these people, and often I have to look at their name tag because, you know, they've seen me, but I maybe didn't spend a lot of time with them. It is like the Harvard where you have this, without intentionally trying, you get this incredible network. And so many people out of Applied Materials, you know, were pretty heavy hitting executives and, you know, went off to do a lot of other things in and around Silicon Valley and around the country. So it's paid off, you know, quite a few times, you know, where, you know, I was meeting with someone from Samsung and she had risen to like the head of supply chain for all of Samsung. And she's like, Jim, remember me from 20 years ago? And I'm like, I don't, but I'm very happy to have this this connection to the head of supply chain for Samsung. So it is definitely a lot of the big companies, they have that kind of, you know, a lot of the same people kind of move around quite a bit. And so you just accidentally kind of knowing a lot of the big players.
I've heard it in the tech industry. I've heard it in the movie industry. Like, there's no upside to being a jerk. You should just be nice to everyone, have good relationships with as many people as you can, because you never know when that lowly newcomer to the industry is going to, X number of years later, work their way up into some amazing position, and you're really going to want to be friendly with them and not have them hanging up on you.
Yeah, a surprisingly large number of people haven't figure that out. So there's some pretty tough characters still in the industry. You know, the semiconductor industry, you know, it had been bouncing around forever. And so it was a kind of a tough environment. I remember McKinsey coming through and telling Applied that, hey, it's dead. You better go big into solar. Semi's dead. Obviously, it's not. So I think what I've noticed in the last 5 or 10 years, as semiconductor is the equipment side, is, you know, tripled last year up to in the 90 billions. And, you know, it's predicted at the end of the decade, $1 trillion of chips and 150 billion in equipment to support that. So as the industry kind of came out of its long doldrums, I'm sure many people listening have read Chip Wars, as it's kind of come out of its long doldrums and it's gotten more momentum, I've noticed that the culture and the companies in are more optimistic, more positive, you know, more friendly, and, you know, less of, you know, a crucible that grinds, you know, grinds the people down into to eke out money, eke out a profit. I notice it's changed quite a bit, but yeah, it's now a great industry to be in.
Let me rewind a sec. So you mentioned moving to ultra clean technology. You had gotten a call from a headhunter and eventually got offered the CEO job there. I guess first, what does ultra clean do? How is that kind of different from AMAT? And second, like, what happens when you land there? What's job one?
So UltraClean, I guess the simplest way to think of it is a contract manufacturer, you know, like everyone's heard of Flex or Fox or Benchmark. The customers were like Applied Materials, Lam, ASM, all the non-Japanese and Korean equipment makers. So making modules and components to the equipment for the semiconductor equipment guys. So, you know, like I mentioned the Lego example of the tools. So, you know, UCT would make a gas panel. Mostly it was making gas panels for, that was about 90% of the revenue. One of the more difficult modules to build for semiconductor tools. That was the majority of what it was doing. And it had grown decently, but it was kind of stuck at around the $400-500 million level for a while, and had decided to take the, you know, its CM know-how and do contract manufacturing for anyone who walked in the door, basically, you know, went and diversify, because semiconductor is notoriously cyclical. I mean, you have 30-40% drops and increases from one year to the next. It's quite a ride. So when I got there, actually, I was offered the COO job and I said no. And the former CEO said, okay, I'm retiring. You can, how about the CEO position? So I'm like, yeah, that would be better. So when I got there, I took everyone into an offsite, all the top management. And because I looked around and we've made a couple machines for, I don't know if I can use their name, a premier electrical car company in the Valley, making a machine that would jam like a hot rotor into a stator. There was another small startup that was laser marking chicken eggs into a machine that would laser mark chicken eggs, 10,000 eggs an hour, you name it, hair growing machines, applying glue to the front face of the cell phone cover, just about anything and everything. And everything was losing money because you'd learn how to do it and then there wouldn't, you know, many repeat orders that were kind of niche stuff. So I took the executives off site and I said, we're a semiconductor. We've been doing it for 30 years. We're really good at it. It's really complex equipment, really hard to do. It's also a low volume, high mix, you know, five of this and 10 of that. We're really good at it. We're not good at all this other stuff. Semiconductor, it's easy to see that chips are going to be in everything everywhere. This is back in 2015 before the boom started, but it was pretty obvious that, you know, that someday my coffee cup will have a chip in it to tell a robot that my coffee is cold and low. And, you know, refrigerators, self-driving cars. I think that it started to be a little bit of penetration into the, you know, into the hard disk space for the cloud to get replaced by solid state chips. So it was obvious that the world was going to be full of chips. You know, at the time there were like 10 chips or 20 chips in a car, and now there's something like 500. So it was easy to see. So I took all the top executives and they still remind me of this because these simple analogies sometimes really stick with people. I said, we're standing in a field with bags of money all around that we can go gather, but we're going off into the woods because we think there might be a bag of money off into the woods somewhere. I said, we're going to stop all this other stuff and we're going to diversify, but we're going to diversify within semiconductors. So instead of just making the gas panel module, let's start making some of the other modules on the tools. We did some acquisitions. We actually bought a company that does this service for semiconductor fabs, you know, cleaning and analytic yield management, bought a few companies to make kind of higher end IP kind of sub product, and just focused on just throwing away anyone who came in the door for anything not semi. And when we bought a company, if it had a non-semi portion, we'd actually usually sell it off and just remain semiconductor focused. And that's worked out pretty well. I think we quickly went in 2 years from 500 million to a billion. And then we've continued that strategy. In 2022, we did 2.4 billion. And as we grew, we had a great global footprint, but we didn't have enough scale and volume over that footprint. So we hadn't been very profitable. But as we grew that revenue over that factory base that we have globally, our profitability shot way up as well. So it's still cyclical. We're in a down cycle right now, but it was definitely turned out to be the right strategy for us.
Yeah, I think betting that chips are going to be in everything is a good bet, and more chips are going to be in everything. You know, I think AI is going to drive even more semiconductor and memory and SSD demand. Where else do you see kind of more penetration of chips in products and industries?
They're pretty much everywhere. I think, obviously, there's always been big waves. Obviously, when the cloud went from hard disk to NAND and a little bit of DRAM, you know, that was a big wave. I think the big new applications, AI, it's unclear. It's like when I talk to investors, they want me to connect the dots from AI is taking off and NVIDIA did this. What does that mean to you now? So that's a really hard dot to connect, but clearly it's going to drive a lot of logic and memory chips. I thought self-driving cars would be more prevalent by now. Back in 2015-16, I thought we would kind of already be there with more of that, but it's still coming, and I think that's going to drive a huge amount of, you know, especially the data to collect for self-driving cars. It, you know, AI is clearly going to have a big effect as well. You know, looking way down the road, and I think robotics are going to be even in everyday, you know, normal consumer's life, not just in factories and things like that. So requiring some AI and a lot of controls and sensors and so on. So I don't see any end in sight. So when the major, you know, in 2015, there were only a few people who were really calling out that chips were going to grow. It seems obvious now, but, you know, Gary Dickerson and, you know, Applied and the folks at Lam were, you know, their marketing people were really showing, you know, what they thought was coming. So there wasn't a lot of voices back then. But, you know, now it's pretty much consensus, you know, to some of the folks at Samsung have told me as well. They see that by the end of the decade, the industry will be $1 trillion in chips. And as I mentioned earlier, and $120 to $150 billion in equipment. So from the $30 billion in equipment to $150, that's quite a growth. So UCT, we put a lot of capacity in place for that growth. We've got 24 sites around the world. Like I said, we're both servicing the fabs, you know, the downstream customers, as well as, you know, the major equipment players outside of Japan. So we're investing into the teeth of this right now, even though it's a downturn in the industry, because, you know, it'll come back relatively shortly, and it'll be another big growth spurt, and there'll be another big supply and demand crunch coming up again. So that's been the cycle, and I think it's like a sine wave where if you take a corner of it and pull it up 45 degrees, it's a sine wave with a lot of growth in it.
Yeah, when it swings big.
Yeah, it comes fast.
Now, you had an interesting quote. You said, basically, I never planned my career. I've been asked at various times in my career about a five-year plan for either me or the company I was at. And I don't know. I mean, like, yeah, I understand not only looking quarter to quarter, but to forecast out 5 years is pretty hard. I think you could give it a heading and, you know, have some good habits along the way. But tell me, like, what you meant by not planning every moment in your career.
Everyone has their mix of bad luck and good luck, opportunities and challenges that kind of hit them. I think it goes all the way back to even like college. I mentioned I wasn't a great student. I didn't have a great grade point. I obviously went to a good school, but I didn't know Michigan from Michigan State. I didn't know anything. You know, and I see, you know, I have four kids of my own, and not all of them, but some stress out about their grades in high school or what college they go into, and certainly their friends. There's a lot of kids stress out about that. And, you know, obviously it's good to get good grades and it's good to go to a premier college, but it's only one element of how you end up, you know, moving forward. And there's other ways around it. I see some of these kids just literally just killing themselves, you know, because of this pressure. And I don't think it's really necessary. I think it's more about when you get out in the workforce, how hard you drive at solving whatever issue or whatever challenge is in front of you. It's around, you mentioned earlier, people skills. That's huge, being able to work in a team and being someone that people like rather than someone who's difficult to deal with. And just when the opportunities knock, you take them. Like I said, bit of fortune, but also, you know, just kind of following, you know, leaving a company that, you know, the first one, which had no future, and going to another, you know, a company which actually made a product, you know, that ended up being a good move. I have found you could be in a really good company with a really good team of people, but if you're in the wrong industry, you struggle. And I've seen companies that are not that great, but they're in a hot industry and they do better than the companies that are well run and in kind of an industry that's stagnant. So it's important to place yourself into the right market in the right industry. If you can get into the right company in that space, that's obviously a good thing too. But once you get there, you know, within a few years of leaving college, nobody's asking you about what grade you got in high school or college. And even what college you went to is less significant than how well you solve problems. Tenacity, I think, is a key attribute. If you just don't give up and you go after solving the issue or the challenge in front of you or, you know, creatively getting around things or creatively making things happen in a collaborative way, that's far more important than grades and what your certificate on your degree means. And if some of the young kids are out there listening today, if you don't get into the college you want, often it's easy to get into the master's program at Berkeley, or, you know, you can get into like high level colleges, or you can get in through going, you know, transferring in through another school. So I think people are often, they overemphasize that part of how you get a career. And I think it's a lot more about what you do when you get in and just taking a look around and seeing, am I in the right spot? Am I in the right industry? Is this company going to go somewhere? And I didn't move around a lot. I worked at most companies for 5 or 10 years each. But when an opportunity came to get into something that, you know, had more upside, you know, I would take it. And yeah, I didn't plan my career. I remember often I get tapped on the shoulder by like my boss's boss, and can you come in my office? I'm like, oh my God, I'm being let go. And he'd say, I just fired your boss and you're taking over his job. So and I'm like, I never I never had eyes. I never had a 5-year plan to take my boss's job. It's just, you know, like I said, if you work hard and you get results, that's the most important. I also think another element is, I think what makes people good at work is when they have a wider experience beyond just, you know, what's in front of them at work. You know, my kids, you know, spent 4 years growing up in Germany and high school. They did summer programs abroad and college, you know, the same thing. You know, they're voracious readers. I was a voracious reader. I read everything in the library, lots of different things I was interested in. You don't know how that's going to connect. You know, like, how does learning history or learning different things, how does that connect into your work life? But when you get this broader, wider perspective, because you've left your narrow world and really became a more sophisticated person, and you get some of that in college just because you're more exposed to interesting people with new ideas all in one place. That's one of the bigger advantages to the university, rather than, you know, I haven't used a Laplace transformation since I left college, you know, or Calc 4 or thermodynamics or any of that. But I think having the breadth of things that you learn about and experiences, you know, I'd love to go back and graduate college having traveled the world. I think those experiences as well make an employee much more sophisticated on how they deal with people and how they deal with challenges.
You had one more story that I definitely wanted you to share with our listeners. It was about not being afraid to make mistakes along the way.
Yeah. So Lockheed was our customer. And as I already mentioned, we were doing this moly disulfide. Moly disulfide is a dry lubricant and it's commonly used, but the problem is it grows columnar and the columns break off. And so we developed this coating where we put 100 angstroms of moly disulfide, and I'm sorry, I'm getting too technical, one atom layer of gold to kind of break up the crystal structure and then start back out again. But so it was a multi-layer gold moly disulfide coating that went on these bearings for the Star Wars program. And these bearings were precisionally ground to like the atom. I mean, it, kind of like the optics in the ASML tools, it's unbelievable precision. They were ground and they were, and this is in the 80s, they were $10,000 each. And I mentioned we were, you know, we the technician and I would be, you know, the Super 8 set the alarm to wake up at 3 a.m. to take the part out of the tool and put the new bearing, you know, the clean bearing in and run another deposition run. And then you have to take the bearing through these different cleaning tanks before you put it in. And the technician had put one in the DI water and forgot about it. And so he came in the next morning and it was still sitting there and it had rusted. So a 10,000, you know, equivalent today of like a $50,000 bearing. You know, we had 10 of these to coat for the program. And we spent a week, we brought in chemists to like, how do you reverse the oxidation process in iron and, you know, replate back on, you know, we tried everything to try to figure a way around it, but you couldn't do that with such a precision bearing. And so finally, after a week of failing, you know, the head of the program and myself got on the phone with our counterpart at Lockheed, and we're so nervous, you know, like, we're sorry we rusted one of your bearings, and we were expecting this tongue lashing and this, you know, we're gonna, you know, why did we choose you, etc. And instead it's like, oh, okay, I'll send a new one tomorrow. so like, yeah, I mean, it's a shame to say we tried all the wrong ways first and then eventually just confessed and it worked out.
Yeah, honesty is usually the best policy.
Sometimes it takes us a while to get there.
So, Jim, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your experiences with the listeners of Underserved.
Thank you, Andrew. It was exciting to be here with you. I really enjoyed it. This was my first podcast I've done, so it was wonderful. Thank you very much.
You'd never know. You did a great job. And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.